This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, U.S. President Donald Trump decertifies the Iran nuclear deal, but stops short of terminating the multilateral agreement. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. President Trump announced last week that he is decertifying Iran's compliance with a multilateral two-year-old nuclear deal and slapping the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps with new counterterrorism sanctions. What does it mean to decertify the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA? The agreement, which was negotiated among six world powers in July 2015 and is considered a signature accomplishment of the Obama administration. How do the other parties to the deal interpret this move by the U.S. government, and what are the broader implications? Despite the move by the Trump administration, European Union foreign ministers pledged to continue supporting the Iran nuclear deal. International inspectors say that Iran is in compliance with the agreement. The ministers worry about the implications for the whole region should the deal fail, and urged America not to impose sanctions on Iran. Meantime, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson said Mr. Trump's action on Iran puts the onus on Congress to decide what to do next. Back in 2015, when the deal was consummated, Congress passed the Iran Nuclear Agreement Review Act, INARA, which obliges the White House to certify Iranian compliance with the deal every 90 days. During the presidential election campaign, Mr. Trump said he would end the agreement, calling it, quote, an embarrassment. Even though he has stopped short of that pledge, President Trump has made clear he has not changed his low opinion of the deal and has threatened to unilaterally withdraw from the Seven-Nation Accord if his concerns are not met. Joining us to discuss the Trump administration's decision to decertify the Iran deal and its ramifications are Behnam Ben Taliblu. He is a senior Iran analyst at Foundation for Defense of Democracies, and Ahmad Majidiar. He is a fellow and the director of the Iran Observed Project at the Middle East Institute. Prior to his post at MEI, Ahmad was for many years a senior research associate at the American Enterprise Institute and a frequent analyst at these VOA microphones. Both gentlemen join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Great to be with you.
Thanks for having us.
First to you, Behnam. What does decertification mean to you, and why didn't Mr. Trump just pull out completely as he promised during the campaign?
I think that's a very important question, because decertification, unlike most of the open source reporting we've been reading, is not akin to a unilateral withdrawal a la Paris Accord or some of the other international agreements like UNESCO that the president has unilaterally withdrawn from. Decertification is basically a middle road based on not an international treaty, but a piece of U.S. legislation, which you mentioned, the Iran Nuclear Agreement Review Act, which actually predates the JCPOA, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action nuclear deal. And according to this piece of U.S. legislation, as you mentioned, the U.S. has to certify Iranian compliance every 90 days and waive sanctions every 120 to 180 days to keep the U.S. a party to the deal. So decertification is the middle option here. It keeps the U.S. in the deal. It puts Iran on notice. It punts the future of the deal debate back to Congress, where they have 60 days to decide if they want to ramp up sanctions, be they nuclear, which would be akin to taking the U.S. out of the deal, or non-nuclear, which would give the president more leverage. And also it shows to the Europeans that the president is serious about keeping some diplomatic option open with Iran while looking to check the rest of Iran's non-nuclear threats.
Turning to you, Ahmad Majidiar, for your take on this decision to decertify the Iran nuclear deal, do you see it, as does Behnam, that this is sort of a middle-of-the-road option, keeps the United States in the deal, but puts the onus on Congress and puts Iran on notice?
I think Behnam is right, that decertification does not mean that the United States has walked away from the deal, but it actually delegates the case to the Congress to decide within the next 60 days whether to reinstate sanctions, and that would abrogate a U.S. part of the deal, or pass a new legislation that fixes some of the loopholes of the deal. I agree with Behnam that the Trump administration does not want to leave the deal because there is no viable alternative to the deal at the moment, and all of the president's advisors have advocated for staying in the deal. But I think that the decertification certainly weakened the deal and cast doubt on the viability and future of the deal, because although the administration perhaps wants to keep it and fix some of the problems, it could trigger a chain of events that could ultimately unravel it.
Behnam Bentaleblu, do you think that it could, as Ahmad said, trigger a chain of events that could ultimately unravel the deal? And of course, we know that the other world powers that helped negotiate the deal are not in favor of withdrawing from the deal. They want to continue. They think that Iran is technically in compliance. How do you see that?
So I would agree with Ahmed, but not necessarily to the same degree of agreement. And here's where I slightly disagree. I think what decertification of the deal does is that it puts leverage back in the U.S.'s hands, because ultimately Iran knew that the U.S. under the Obama administration was tied to the deal and was willing to overlook Iran's regional aggression, was willing to overlook Iran's testing of ballistic missiles, was willing to overlook Iran's human rights violations because it desperately needed this deal. Usually in international relations, doubt is a currency you don't want to have. But in this case, I think doubt could be useful, because just by generating some doubt over the debate of the future of the deal, the president has gotten the Europeans to be a bit more serious in the UN Security Council about ballistic missile testing. You've had the president of France, Macron, on the UNGA floor devote a portion of his UNGA speech to the same themes President Trump mentioned, Iranian ballistic missiles and the sunset clauses in the deal. So ultimately, it's up to the president now in the next 60 days to capitalize on this doubt and to unite the transatlantic community and prevent Iran's President Rouhani from dividing the transatlantic community using the same doubt. So doubt is good, but who will be the owner of the doubt and who will marshal the doubt is what we're going to have to wait and see for the next 60 days.
So Ahmed Majidiar, how do you respond to Behnam's comment that the U.S. could get leverage on this, perhaps unite the transatlantic community on these issues, and anything to add or subtract to the exact objections that the administration, this Trump administration, has with respect to the deal, why they wanted to take a pause, decertify? What are other specific objections, sunset clauses, if you could elaborate on that?
First, doubt and unpredictability can sometimes be important for negotiations, but there is a difference between doubt and confusion and incoherence. So right now, a lot of the U.S. allies, especially the European powers, Germany, France, and Britain, who are also the signatories of the deal, they do not side with the administration's very tough line on the Iran deal, because all of them have made it clear that they want this deal to be implemented and kept, not scrapped. So at this point, I think that by decertifying, and also President Trump recently pledged to terminate the deal if the Congress does not make any new legislation and fix some of those loopholes, then I think that the U.S. has isolated itself. Previously, we saw that Iran was seen as a pariah state by much of the international community, and it was the international sanctions that brought Iran to the negotiating table. But somehow, right now, Iran has become the aggrieved victim here, and the United States is seen as a belligerent force trying to violate an international agreement. So it is not in the national interest of the United States to isolate itself, because it's important to know that the European allies all share the administration's concern about Iran's non-nuclear activities, especially regarding the missile activities and also Iran's malign activities and subversive actions in the Middle East, because European countries have suffered from some of the Iranian military adventurism in the Middle East. Most of the Syrian refugees, for example, they have come to Germany, France, and Britain, and they have created chaos there. So they share that concern. So that's important for Washington to work with those allies to put pressure on Iran to change Iran's behavior and also increase its leverage, not to isolate itself.
That leads me to ask you, Behnam Bentaleblu, couldn't the U.S. still certify the deal and still be tough on Iran with regard to its non-nuclear but very nefarious activities in the region, whether it's supporting Hezbollah, its support of the murderous Bashar al-Assad regime in Syria? In other words, we know that many have criticized the Obama administration for what they consider a flawed deal, but still it's better than the alternative. And they say that there is nothing in the deal that precludes the United States from still taking action on these matters while still supporting the deal and even certifying it.
That's absolutely right. The nuclear deal through some creative logic, stovepipes the Iranian nuclear threat from the rest of the threat that Iran poses to the region and to it, actually its own people. So I like to paint the Iran threat package as a bit of a wedding cake. So you have the top layer, which is where the bride and groom is, and it's the most attractive one, and it's the one that takes up all the oxygen in the room, and that's the nuclear threat. But the reason on a wedding cake that top tier is so high, it's buoyed by several other layers. So the nuclear issue is only new with Iran. It's only been since 2006. The other threats are, as you mentioned, terrorism, ballistic missile, regional instability, illicit finance, human rights. So no Obama administration official, despite saying that the agreement does not preclude tough measures against these threats, actually took tough measures against these threats, which is a problem. So now I think decertification shows us something else, that we're going to take the Iran nuclear threat, the United States of America, and put it back into the strategic context that drove it. No country on the face of the earth has pursued a nuclear weapons program through a strategic vacuum. Iran has reasons, status reasons, security reasons for wanting to pursue a nuclear weapons program. And I hope what comes of this debate is a more comprehensive Iran policy that doesn't deal with a nuclear threat in isolation, that doesn't deal with a regional threat in isolation, that deals with the Iran threat in a more comprehensive fashion, that you can gain leverage on one negotiating table by escalating in one theater of conflict, and vice versa.
How do you see that, Ahmad Majidiar, that this decertification just gives the United States more leverage to, in fact, act vis-a-vis Iran's nefarious activities, whether it's ballistic missiles or its support of terrorism in the region? Or do you think that, as others have argued, that you can still certify the deal and simultaneously still take these actions?
I think I would agree with the latter approach, that the administration should have certified the Iran nuclear deal. It should not have created the confusion that is now present here. And also it should have not burned the bridge with the European allies, because ultimately their support for countering Iran's regional activities as well as ballistic missile program is very crucial. But let's make no mistake, Iran deal is not perfect. It has so many loopholes. It does not address Iran's ballistic missile program, because ballistic missile program is not even mentioned in the nuclear agreement. It is enshrined in the UN Security Council resolution, but that does not obligate Iran to abstain from testing ballistic missiles. It just only calls upon Iran, and Iran actually, since the deal was signed, has further enhanced its ballistic missile program. But what I'm saying is that the decertification was a distraction from building an international coalition to tackle these Iranian challenges and problems. And the United States has isolated itself, and now we see that the Europeans, China, Russia, and others have become the de facto spokesperson for the Iranian regime, and they are siding more with Iran rather than with the United States.
You're listening to Encounter on The Voice of America. My guests are Behnam Bentaleblu, he's senior Iran analyst at Foundation for Defense of Democracies, and Ahmad Majidiar, from whom you just heard, fellow and director of the Iran Observed Project at the Middle East Institute. We're discussing the future of the Iran nuclear deal in the wake of the Trump administration's decision to decertify Iran's compliance with the nuclear agreement. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA. Here's a shout out to loyal listener Vitu Kin. He's from Kampot, Cambodia. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. We're back to you, Behnam Bentaleblu, to talk about what the next step is now that the Trump administration has decided to decertify the Iran nuclear deal. It doesn't withdraw the United States from it, but it, as you said, punts the decision over to Congress. Talk about the role of Congress right now. What are they expected to do, and what do you think they are likely to do?
This is where the debate actually does get tricky, because domestic politics can come in, but so can, of course, different sanctions timelines. Congress has 60 days to decide what to do with the future of the deal. I think the least likely option is that Congress would pass nuclear sanctions, which would take the U.S. essentially out of the deal and violate the accord. That's not going to happen. Another opportunity for Congress is to pass non-nuclear sanctions. This is slightly more likely, but also not entirely likely, because Congress passed sanctions in July and the president signed into public law in August that targeted Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, domestic ballistic missile program, and required the administration to come up with a comprehensive Iran policy. So Congress is going to say, we already did that. What can we do next? The most likely option is that Congress will work with the administration to develop these things called trigger points that would essentially have deadline-triggered sanctions on Iranian regional activity and on Iranian nuclear activity. So if Iran puts its feet just an inch out of the box on the Iranian compliance or just an inch out of the box on the regional issue, sanctions would automatically be reimposed. And they would have to work with the administration to figure out what those issues are, what those red lines would be. And of course, Congress would lend political support to the administration to use executive level sanctions through the Treasury Department and through the State Department to go after Iranian entities that continue to violate their obligations by using illicit finance and illicit procurement networks to get stuff for their ballistic and nuclear programs.
Quick clarification. Do we already have sanctions on the IRGC, the International Revolutionary Guard Corps?
We do have a fairly robust set of sanctions on the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. But what the speech last Friday by President Trump did is he lived up to essentially congressional legislation that required the president through statute to designate the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps as a terrorist organization, not according to the State Department, which maintains the foreign terrorist organization list, but pursuant to an executive order, which requires the president and the secretary of the treasury to block the assets, freeze the property, and sanction any individuals that they decide to list that meet the definition of terrorism. And so the IRGC, since 2007, has been debated in this town. Does it meet that definition? And finally, the president weighed in on that debate and said yes. So that is the icing on the cake of IRGC sanctions.
So he said yes, so the Congress doesn't have to ratify that. That's just,
That's purely executive. The Congress required the president to make that finding, and after 90 days, the president did make that finding.
Your reaction, Ahmed Majidiar, with respect to what Congress needs to do now or is likely to do?
Yes, I agree with Behnam that the Iranian actions in the region have to be confronted, and also Iran's missile program is a challenge and a threat to regional security and to international security that also needs to be addressed. But I would just emphasize that the United States does not have that leverage that it had prior to the signing of the nuclear agreement, because at that time it was the crippling international sanctions with the support of the Europeans, China, Russia, and other international allies that brought Iran to the negotiating table. So right now, if we think that we can just make Iran do everything without international support, the United States does not have that leverage. The new sanctions against the IRGC, that can be effective in deterring some of the international companies from doing business with Iran, because ultimately IRGC is involved in a lot of economic sectors of Iran. So many companies would not now do business with the Islamic Republic. But it would do very little in terms of Iran's regional activities. And I don't see a very coherent and comprehensive strategy from the Trump administration to counter Iran's growing influence from South Asia all the way to the Middle East and Eastern Mediterranean. Right now, the Trump administration has been very tough when it talks about Iran's actions, but it has done little about Iran's proxies, for example, in Syria and Iraq.
Well, that's an interesting point, because it appears that the United States is sort of tacitly in cahoots with Iran, whether in Syria and even in Iraq, since Iran is very supportive of the Iraqi regime as well as the Syrian regime in order to combat the so-called Islamic State. Do you see a contradiction there, Behnam?
Yes, I definitely see a contradiction there. And hopefully U.S. policy would not be aligning with the Islamic Republic in the region, because I would say ultimately they're diametrically opposed, even though there may be some confluence. So where there may be some confluence is that the U.S. definitely seems to support the territorial integrity of Iraq. The Islamic Republic has said the same thing. Both countries have been against the Kurdistan referendum that recently happened on September 25th. Iran much more vociferously against it than Washington, but still against it nonetheless. Ultimately, I don't see Iran as playing a positive role in the region or combating ISIS in the way the U.S. does. Iran simply gets the media credit for it when they repatriate their bodies back from the theaters of conflict. There are these highly public, elaborate mourning ceremonies. But rather, it's the deployment of IRGC forces to theaters like Syria and Iraq. It's the use of Shia militias. It's the abuse of South Asian refugee populations in Iran. It's the marshalling of these people that Iran basically sends into these theaters of conflict as its own foreign agents and as its own foreign legion that gets the Arab Sunni populations upset at Iran, that heightens sectarianism in the region, that fuels the refugee crisis, that aids Bashar al-Assad in his slaughter of the civilian population. So I don't see the U.S. doing any of that, fortunately, but Iran is doing that. Where I do agree with Ahmed, though, is that the Trump administration needs to take its more muscular rhetorical approach to Iran and translate that into action. And key places where they can translate that into action is Syria, by having a cohesive Syria policy. I don't know where this administration will be weighing in on the future of Assad, on Iran's proxies, or on the future of Iraq, for that matter.
Back to you, Ahmed Majidiar. It's my understanding that your argument is the United States could do all that and still certify the Iran nuclear deal. What is the reaction from Iran? with respect to this decertification. How does that play out, and is that positive or negative?
Yeah, first of all, let me just briefly say that I agree with Behnam with all the Iranian challenges that he mentioned about the Middle East. And again, I'd like to just reiterate my point that the decertification has been a distraction from countering the real challenges that Iran poses to the region and to international security.
And with respect to Iran's posture vis-a-vis the deal, what impact does this decertification have on Iran's compliance with the deal henceforth and its activities in the region?
The decertification is not related to the Iran nuclear agreement. So that's why the Iranian government has made it clear that for now, it will stick to the deal and it will remain in the deal as long as other signatories of the deal remain committed to the terms of the agreement. But if the United States ultimately leaves the deal, Iran has two options. Iran will either resume nuclear enrichment and leave the deal, or Iran will try to remain in the deal and try to work with the European powers as well as with Russia and China to minimize the impact of the new U.S. sanctions. But if the Rouhani government chooses to remain in sanctions, I think that it will come under tremendous pressure from the hardliners who opposed the Iran nuclear deal at the first place, especially from the IRGC, because of the new U.S. sanctions hurt the IRGC's economic activities, so they don't see any benefit in the nuclear agreement.
Well, back to you, Behnam Bentaleblou. There's also the concern by some that the current position by the Trump administration to decertify the deal implies that America's commitments to its international agreements are not firm. Of course, the administration says, on the contrary, that this sends a signal, for example, to North Korea, who is developing a nuclear program, who has a nuclear program, and they're saying that, no, this decertification sends a signal to North Korea that we don't support or we will not abide by weak agreements. Which is it?
I mean, ultimately, the signal will be in the eye of the perceiver. Signaling resolve, signaling your intentions, or signaling capability is one of the most toughest things to do in international relations because it involves more than one party. But I'm largely inclined to agree with the Tehran-Pyongyang framing you've mentioned here because the United States has a rich history of abrogating nuclear deals with the Soviet Union. It has a rich history of inking follow-on deals with a successor to the Soviet Union. You got START 1, START 2 with the Russian Federation. So to say that our entire credibility would be damaged simply by changing our posture on a deal, I think would be a little bit disingenuous, with all due respect. And looking at North Korea in particular, North Korea is not extending the olive branch to the United States of America right now. It's increased ballistic missile testing, it's continued nuclear testing, and it continues to be in defiance of the six-party talks, it continues to be in defiance of multiple UN Security Council resolutions, and ultimately it is not interested in negotiating with the United States right now because the United States' policy rightly involves denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. To say that decertification is risky is true, but without risk, there will be no reward. But what is factual and does not involve any kind of guesswork is that after 10 years, if we stick to the deal absent any attempt to fix it or abrogate it or get a follow-on deal, Iran's regional threats will not only be buoyed by the sanctions relief it will receive under the deal, it'll be buoyed by the fact that Iran will have basically zero breakout to get a nuclear weapon. It'll be buoyed by the fact that Iran's economy will be insulated from international sanctions and it'll be left with an industrial-scale nuclear program. So decertification and the regional issue are actually linked a little bit, even though the deal does not address Iran's regional behavior. This country is not North Korea rushing towards a bomb. This country is its own model. It's incrementally moving towards a bomb in the safest way possible across two different regimes, across multiple generations, because they don't want to be hit. They don't want to become a North Korea to be an international pariah. They want to remain in the international community, but also reap its dividends.
Well, the last word to you, Ahmed Majidiar. Regarding U.S. credibility on the world stage with regard to this decertification, does it in any way undermine it, or does it in fact strengthen it?
There is a consensus in the U.S. national security establishment that there is no military solution to the North Korean crisis, and diplomacy and negotiation will ultimately be the solution to the issue. So if the United States is violating a multilateral agreement with Iran, and that is on the nuclear issue, then it would dissuade the North Korean regime from resolving its own dispute diplomatically. It would send a very wrong signal to them that even if they reach an agreement with the United States over its nuclear issue, that would not be permanent, or that would be used somehow by the U.S. government as a pressure to seek more concessions in future. So that ultimately just hurts the U.S. position regarding North Korea, not strengthening it.
I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Behnam Ben Taliblu, he's Senior Iran Analyst at Foundation for Defense of Democracies, and Ahmed Majidiar, Fellow and Director of the Iran Observed Project at the Middle East Institute. Gentlemen, thanks so much for your terrific insights. Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Rebecca Ward for booking our guests. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.